And our next speaker is Jesse Meyer with a great introduction already. I'll add to it. Jesse is currently a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph and has a bachelor's degree in environmental geology from the University of Montana, her home state, where she's from, and a master's degree in hydrogeology from the University of Waterloo. Between her master's and PhD degrees, Jesse worked as a research associate at the University of Waterloo with Beth and with John Cherry, where she helped develop high-resolution field characterization methods that have already been alluded to, and co-developed a customized relational database and managed research activities at a contaminated sedimentary rock field site in Wisconsin outside of Madison. Her research focuses on field-based characterization of fractured sedimentary rock flow systems and aquitard hydrology using a combination of diverse methods, including high-resolution depth discrete hydraulic head and response data sets. We should see some of that in action as she talks with us today on high-resolution head profiles for flow system characterization in fractured sedimentary rocks. Jesse.
That's a mouthful. Good morning. I just want to start by thanking you for this opportunity. This is really exciting to see the amount of interest in this particular topic. I also want to acknowledge my co-authors on this presentation, my supervisors, Dr. Parker and Dr. Cherry. And with that, I think I'll just get going. So we're going to be talking about a field site that I've been doing my PhD research at that's located just outside Madison, Wisconsin. So this slide is just to give you a sense of scale. Hopefully you can see. I see it's a bit difficult. But essentially what we're working with here is a mixed organics dissolved phase plume that's migrating through fractured sandstone. And that plume, at its maximum extent, impacted about a 4 kilometer square area. So it's a sizable problem. And we're currently involved in trying to construct numerical models of groundwater flow and contaminant transport that can be used to help decision making at this site in terms of investigating remedial options and just better understanding this problem in general. So we're working in the Cambrian and Ordovician aquifer system outside Madison here, and this is just a slide to remind us that this is a regionally extensive aquifer system, as I'm sure you're familiar. So many of the rock units that we're working with here in southern Wisconsin are very similar to those right here in the Minneapolis area. So this is just a slide showing the specific stratigraphy on site. It's a cartoon. But essentially, we're dealing with the Cambrian units from the Mount Simon Formation sandstone all the way up through some of the Ordovician units like the Prairie du Chien Group Dolostone. In addition, at this site, we run into the Cambrian Ordovician unconformity that underlies the St. Peter Formation. And this particular unconformity and associated geologic units makes things a little more complex. So this is the site if we zoom into the plume scale, essentially. So here you can see the plume outlined in orange. It's a well-monitored plume. There's over 154 monitoring locations on site. Groundwater flow is generally kind of from west to east, but tends to rotate towards the south as you move deeper through these units. And as I said before, the maximum extent of our plume in 2003 was about 3 kilometers long. So that plume that you see on the map is actually migrating through the upper part of the Tunnel City Group sandstones that are anywhere between 150 and 180 feet below ground surface at site. And this plume is directly overlying what is known to be a regional aquitard in the area, parts of the Eau Claire Formation, as well as the regional water supply aquifer, the Mount Simon Formation. So we think that this is a pretty relevant problem, and so that makes it even more interesting to study, I think. So just as a quick reminder, what we're working towards right now is creating both conceptual and numerical models for groundwater flow and contaminant transport on site. And one of the first steps in doing that is defining the hydrogeologic or hydrostratigraphic units. So this definition becomes a critical task. So this is just a quick definition of hydrogeologic units so that we can all be on the same page. What we're talking about here are just partitions of the subsurface that are hydraulically consistent at whatever scale or question we're interested in, really. And these are used as the framework for our conceptual and our numerical models. So we're all familiar with, I think, the terms aquifer and aquitard. These are specific types of HGUs. And so we have kind of the higher permeability range with our aquifers that we know are able to supply water to wells versus our aquitard units, which we think about as limiting vertical flow in these groundwater flow systems. And then we have everything in between on that spectrum of hydrogeological units. So the question on site is, how many hydrogeological units are there, and what data sets are useful for delineating those units in these fractured sedimentary rock systems? And this is a guess. Oftentimes, the system is modeled as kind of a three-unit bedrock system with the upper rock units lumped together, separated by the Eau Claire aquitard, and then the Mount Simon formation aquifer underlying the whole thing. So some data sets that are commonly used to delineate hydrogeologic units are things like stratigraphy, perhaps lithologic logs from continuous core or cuttings, geophysical logs, and then also hydraulic conductivity. I think as hydrogeologists, we have an intuitive sense that our hydraulic conductivity data should give us really useful information on what's an aquifer versus an aquitard unit, et cetera. So I want to show you some of the hydraulic conductivity data from this site. So essentially what I've plotted here is hydraulic conductivity on the x-axis. Okay, so hydraulic conductivity here, and then I've plotted essentially the points with elevation and color-coded them based on their stratigraphy. And I think what you can take away from this plot is it's not all that clear. There's over a 6-order of magnitude spread in hydraulic conductivity on site. In fact, there's over a 5-order of magnitude spread in the hydraulic conductivity of the Tunnel City Group sandstones alone. This isn't that surprising considering we're dealing with a dual permeability system, but it calls into question how useful this data set is for delineating these units. So this figure is really put in here. It's a classical flow system figure from Fries and Witherspoon's paper to remind us that the hydraulic head distribution, or the potential field, is going to be a reflection of our permeability distribution. So it stands to reason that if we can measure the hydraulic head in detail at a location in the vertical direction, that we should be able to kind of see these changes in hydraulic conductivity that are expressed as kind of kinks in these equipotential lines. So this is kind of our working hypothesis here, is that we can use high-resolution head profiles to give us some information about these hydrogeologic units. So that hypothesis is just restated here. So just to get on the same page with this high-resolution term, what we're talking about here are both depth-discrete data sets and very detailed data sets. So essentially, we're trying to, with our multi-level systems, create very short monitoring intervals and a lot of them in one vertical profile. So the multi-level systems, just a quick refresher, we're talking about a single device installed in a borehole that can be used to monitor hydraulic head and sample for groundwater, perhaps even do hydraulic tests in many depth discrete intervals. And there's three companies that produce four multi-levels that are useful for fractured rock applications, and those are shown here. We have Schlumberger with the West Bay system. Solenst produces both the Waterloo system and the continuous multi-channel tube, or CMT, system. And then we have the water flutes. And so that's a version of the flute liner that Beth was talking about, but instead of being a continuous seal, you interrupt that seal with monitoring intervals. So we're going to be talking about and looking at data collected from West Bay systems today. So I'm going to try and explain why we used West Bay systems for this particular application. So with the flute system, the Solent system, and the CMT system, we have a maximum number of ports that's dependent on a variety of things. In the CMT system, it's set. You can have up to 7 ports in the system. That's the maximum. The maximum number of ports that a flute can accommodate is really dependent on the number of tubes that you can fit in the hole. And the maximum number of ports that a Waterloo system can accommodate is dependent on the number of tubes that you can fit down the 2-inch PVC casing. West Bay systems are unique in that they're modular systems that actually use valved ports that you see here. So this is a measurement port where you can sample for pressure heads and groundwater samples, and then this is a pumping port that you can use to do hydraulic tests. And what's unique about this is there are no tubes. Instead of a tube from the port running to ground surface, you use a downhole tool that goes to each of these ports and accesses these valved ports. So this is just a schematic of that process and the tool that you use. So what this means is we can fit a lot more ports in a West Bay system because we're not limited by tubing in casing diameters. So why the West Bay system for this application? We can maximize the number of ports. In addition, they have a number of QAQC procedures that give us a lot of confidence in the packer seals. And then because you're using the same pressure transducer on that downhole tool, and because it's a very accurate transducer, you can essentially have an accuracy in your head measurements of plus or minus 1 centimeter. So you can reliably differentiate head up to by a difference of about 2 centimeters. So this results in high resolution head profiles, which is what we're looking for. So our approach here is we go out and we core a hole, we log that core in detail for the geology and the fractures, and then we also do a standard suite of geophysical logs, as well as these hydrophysical logs that Beth was discussing, and then we design and install a multi-level system. So the goals here in designing this multi-level system is we want to avoid blending HGUs, or we want to avoid blending our aquifer units, and we also want to maximize the number of our monitoring zones. This is tricky because most of the data that we collect, this is a typical DFN data set from one of the boreholes at the Wisconsin site, most of this data is indirect data with respect to hydraulics. So we're trying to infer hydraulic properties from our geological data or our geophysical data. We do have data such as the active line source temperature logging, which is giving an indication of flow, as well as the flute K profiling. But it's still an iterative and kind of a tricky process to determine where to place your packers and how long to make your monitoring intervals to avoid cross-connecting potential hydrogeologic units. So that's just a key point here. These geological and geophysical data sets are critical, but those data sets alone can't predict where these hydraulic changes are going to happen necessarily. So now we're going to start taking a look at some of this West Bay data. The first thing we'll look at is a specific multi-level design for the MP16 well that's north of the plume here. So this is the design that we ended up with. We have 46 monitoring intervals over about 130 meters of rock. That ends up being about 1.8 zones per every 10 meters. So this is what we mean by high resolution. So before we get into the actual data sets, I just want to kind of bring us all onto the same page with some of these plots. So this is the style of plot that you'll see. Essentially, we're always plotting the stratigraphy over here because it's a really useful way to kind of orient ourselves, right? And then we have the hydraulic head profile. So we just have hydraulic head on the x-axis versus depth or elevation on the y-axis. And then I'm going to use the term inflection quite a bit. And what I mean by that is a large change in head, or a very distinct change in head over a small depth interval. And for each of those inflections, you can calculate the vertical component of hydraulic gradient. So we're just taking the change in head between two adjacent monitoring intervals and dividing by the length of the packer seal between the two. This gives us the maximum vertical gradient that you can calculate based on your well construction, essentially. And it's a nice way to calculate it because it means your gradients are calculated consistently throughout the system. So then we can plot those vertical gradients up here next to the head profiles, and I use a convention of a blue bar to represent a downward vertical gradient, so we have a decrease in head with depth, and a red bar to represent an upward vertical gradient. So let's get into this data set. So we're going to start at the MP6 well, which is upgradient of the plume. This data set was published in Environmental Geology in 2008. And so what you have here is you have your stratigraphy. Remember that our problem, our plume, is migrating through the upper part of the Tunnel City Group, the green unit here. And then we have the head profile and the calculated gradients. And I just wanted to point out on this gradient profile that this gradient is off the chart. It's actually a gradient of minus 1.2. And we commonly see gradients above or greater than 1 when we're using these high-resolution systems. So one thing to point out here is these head profiles are very geometric. They're not erratic and wiggly and kind of crazy as we maybe would expect from a fractured rock system. And they get this geometry from these thick sections of no measurable vertical gradient. This is really indicative of a predominance of horizontal flow and an interconnected fracture network that's then separated by thin sections of large vertical gradient or inflections. And these are representative of a resistance to flow. In addition, if you look at kind of the position of these inflections, they don't always match up with our stratigraphic contacts, and they don't always occur perhaps across an entire stratigraphic unit. So that's something that's really important to keep in mind conceptually. So these head profiles are also quite repeatable. I have been showing you a head profile from August or from December of 2003, and now I've added the profile from August 2011. So that's a pretty large time period between these head profiles, and they're very consistent. What we can do is we can plot these vertical gradients in time, because fortunately, we didn't just measure the profile in 2003 and 2011. We measured it all along in between those two time periods. So these are vertical gradients calculated and then plotted in time. So we have time on the x-axis and gradient on the y-axis. And you can see that they're very consistent. They're consistent in their magnitude as well as their direction. So this is encouraging in terms of using this data set in an interpretive fashion. So just some key points. We have geometric head profiles that are quite repeatable. We don't find that the stratigraphy necessarily predicts the position of these inflections, and we have some thin sections of large vertical gradients. So I think the big question here is, well, that's great. These look like nice data sets, but what do they mean? What do these inflections actually represent? And so we know that they're really representative of a resistance to vertical flow, but we think there's kind of two types of that resistance. We have what I think we would normally consider, which is a low bulk vertical K unit, an aquitard, so a clay or a shale or something that we'd think of as being tight. Or they may also actually represent a contact or an interface that's restricting vertical flow in the system. So I'm going to start with the case of kind of a low bulk vertical conductivity unit with this regional aquitard, the Eau Claire aquitard. And that's just shown in cross-section here from the Mississippi River to Lake Michigan. So in southern Wisconsin, it's commonly thought of as shale because the type section for the Eau Claire is a shale. But in this particular part of Wisconsin, this is a sandstone. It's very, very sandy. At best, it's a muddy sandstone. It has a very distinctive gamma signature that's often used as an indication of the aquitard unit. And both the formation and the aquitard itself are known to be discontinuous in this part of Wisconsin. So let's take a look at what our head data might tell us about the Eau Claire aquitard. So we're going to take a look at data from the four regional wells at the site. These are regional because they're outside of the plume. They're also deep, so they get into the Mount Simon Formation aquifer. So this is gamma logs from those four wells, and you can see the Eau Claire stratigraphic unit is in purple, and the stratigraphic unit is about 8 meters thick on site. It's not the easiest stratigraphic unit to delineate, so there's some variability there. So now, if we take a look at our head data, what I've plotted here are the hydraulic head profiles as well as the vertical gradients calculated across the Eau Claire formation. And these are useful. You can see that we have some vertical gradients toward the bottom of the unit. But what's also important is to understand where we're seeing no measurable vertical gradient. And so what I've done is I've essentially shaded our gamma log based on the vertical gradients that we've measured. So the blue bars represent a downward vertical gradient, the black shading represents no measurable vertical gradient, and then we have these gray areas where sometimes there's a little small gradient that may or may not actually be there. And I think what you can see from this is it's not as clear-cut as just using the stratigraphic unit itself as an aquitard unit. And I think that's been known for some time. But then the question is, how do you narrow it down? And I think the vertical gradient or the head profile data gives us a really good means to do that. So it's suggesting that we're looking here for our aquitard unit, so more towards the bottom of this stratigraphic unit. And so what we do is we go back to our geology, our detailed lithologic logs, our geophysical data sets, and try to narrow down what's actually producing that inflection. So what I have here, this is essentially a lithology log. We have some geophysics, and I'm using that data to narrow down what I think is producing this change in head. So this is just a picture of some of the core collected across that interval, and you can see what happens is essentially the unit fines up a little bit, gets a little more muddy. And if I take that data and I interpret an aquitard unit, this is what I come out with, which is shown here. So we have an aquitard unit that's maybe about a meter thick as compared to the stratigraphic unit, which is over 8 meters thick. So that makes a big difference when you're thinking about this unit resisting vertical flow, if it's much, much thinner than you would have necessarily imagined. In addition, at the MP16 well, we don't see much evidence for this aquitard unit, so it may not actually be present at that particular location. So the second type of resistance of flow that we'll talk about, just to finish this off, is the possibility of a contact or an interface that restricts vertical flow. And so if we take a look at an example, we can look at the inflection towards the bottom of the Tunnel City Group sandstones. So if we look at our detailed core logs and we look at our core itself, what we found is we can't find a clay or a shale bed or something that we think would be tight and producing this inflection. So that was kind of perplexing. So the hypothesis here is that some of these inflections actually represent a discontinuity between fracture networks of adjacent units. And that really comes out of the geomechanical literature and the concept of mechanical units. So essentially a mechanical unit or a mechanical layer is a unit of rock that has a certain mechanical properties and behaves a certain way when it's stressed. So you end up with a fracture network. And that network might be very different from the adjacent unit if these two units have different mechanical properties. And one thing that we know from the geomechanical literature is that vertical fractures don't extend across these interfaces. So what Michelle Cook and some of her students have shown is that this can create a discontinuity that's restricting vertical flow. And so perhaps this is an explanation for some of these inflections in the head profile that we're seeing. So we wanted to test this hypothesis. So we utilized one of these discrete fracture network models, the FracTran model that Beth was showing results from earlier. So what we did is we set up a simulation, and we're using parameters from the site that are representative of the Tunnel City Group sandstone, and we created a four-layer system, shown here, and each of these layers has the same matrix and bulk properties. We wanted to make them very similar hydraulically, but all we did was we restricted the connection of vertical fractures between these units. When we restricted it, we didn't set it to zero. There are vertical fractures that are going between the units. When we run this model, what we find is we get simulated head profiles that are very similar in style to what we're measuring in the field. So this suggests to us that this may be a possible mechanism for producing some of these inflections. So what that is representative of, likely, is kind of stacked aquifer units that just aren't very well connected in a vertical sense. So we take all of this information and we use it to interpret our hydrogeologic units. And we're going to interpret these inflections as either occurring across a contact between HGUs or occurring across a low bulk hydraulic conductivity HGU or an aquitard. And when we do that at the MP6 hole, we get 11 hydrogeologic units defined for that particular location. And this is different than what was defined on site previous to these studies, which was a five-unit system, as well as kind of what's regionally thought of as a three-unit system. So I also wanted to show some hydraulic conductivity data for this particular borehole. These are Packer test data, and these are in centimeters per second. This is 10 to the minus 4. These I-beams actually represent values that are very, very high, kind of above the resolution of our testing equipment. And what you can see here is that we have a moderate to high horizontal conductivity throughout the entire section. So I think this is really representative of this concept of these units being more like stacked aquifer units that are perhaps not very well connected in a vertical sense between themselves. So the last thing that I want to show you is essentially a long sect from kind of the upgradient location to the downgradient location utilizing these high-resolution head profiles. Because I've shown you head data from a couple of these wells, so I'd like to show you what they look like all together. So one important thing that's coming out of these head profiles is that if you take a look, so here we're moving from west to east, and here you can see that all the gradients are down, all the bars are blue. And this is really indicative of a recharge area. And then as you move across the site, we're getting some red bars in the upper parts of the units that are indicative of a discharge area. That matches our expectations given that there's a wetland in the middle of this, in the middle of this plume, essentially. So these vertical gradients, their directions, are giving us a really nice indication of our position in the overall flow system. In addition, if you look, you can see that these gradients are actually correlating across the site. So this is the Eau Claire gradients. There's a small but incredibly consistent gradient in the middle of the Wanawak Formation, gradient kind of towards the bottom of the Tunnel City Group, and so on. So what we're in the process of doing is correlating these units in three dimensions based on the vertical gradients and then informed by all of our detailed geologic and geophysical data sets. And what we end up with, you remember our original question is how many HGUs are there or might there be? We end up with something more like 13 potential hydrogeologic units on site. And this is still a work in process. It's a complicated system as you get towards the top of these units, but certainly more than the original conceptual model of about five. And then we can also kind of plot up a schematic flow system where we have a predominance of horizontal flow in these units and then some vertical leakage between them that is reflected in these vertical gradients. So the thing that I'd like to close with is to try to convince you that this just isn't something magical happening in southern Wisconsin. We're actually seeing very similar head profiles at our other fractured rock research sites, one in California that Beth was talking about, as well as in our hometown in Guelph, Ontario. So these are head profiles. This one's measured through the Guelph Silurian Dolostone. This is measured through a Cretaceous sandstone in California. And what you see is we still have these geometric head profiles. So we have these large sections of no measurable vertical gradient separated by sharp inflections. We're seeing very large vertical gradients, often greater than one. And they're also very repeatable. So this isn't restricted to the site in Wisconsin, it seems to be something that's common or common to these layered sedimentary rock systems. So just a summary of key points here. We're finding it difficult to predict the position of these inflections just based on our geologic and our geophysical data alone. And these inflections seem to be occurring for two reasons. One, as due to discontinuities between fracture networks of adjacent units or across something that we consider more like a classical aquitard. And we find these high-resolution head profiles really valuable for understanding our flow system and defining these units. So with that, I'll leave you with a picture of a typical West Bay installation in Wisconsin and take any questions if we have time.
One or two questions.
You can see in layered system, obviously you have seen the head gradients that they are inflection that you have seen it. Have you noticed or have you seen any changes because of the wetting and drying cycles?
because of the wetting and drying cycles. All of these profiles that I'm showing in these units that we're working in, these are all under saturated conditions all of the time. The one exception is the site in California has a very thick unsaturated zone, but our multi-level systems don't really give us any or much useful data from that particular part of the section.
Thank you.
I would like to ask you, you talked about the uncertainty in measuring the heads. Did you account for that in your interpretation?
Yes,
in the
essentially.
Gradients, especially when they are small gradients?
Yes. Basically, what we do is we've calculated the uncertainty in the head value to be plus or minus 1 centimeter. So when I calculate vertical gradients, I don't consider anything that's less than 2 centimeters of head differential. So everything that you saw plotted was greater than a difference of 2 centimeters of head. And then in addition to that, what we're using to kind of strengthen our faith in that data, I guess, is that these are very repeatable in time. And also, we're finding that they're correlatable in space. So we're using those two dimensions to help fortify our understanding of those gradients.
Last question, Justin.
I'm interested in finding out were those slug tests that you were doing on those Packer intervals, or and how would that compare to, say, other large-scale, typical pumping tests that have been done at the site?
Sure. The one very detailed profile that you saw were slug tests done in 2-foot Packer intervals, so very, very small Packer intervals. Typically, for most of the units, if we do the large-scale test, we get a larger hydraulic conductivity usually, because some of those very small Packer intervals are intersecting zones of the borehole that don't necessarily have many fractures. And also aren't testing a very large volume of rock. But in general, much of this section is fairly conductive.
And it sounds like this is also reinforcing the idea of the aquatardifer.
It's very much enforcing the idea of the aquatardifer.
Which we'll hear about after the break, which we're going to take now.